Chapter 5. A large crowd of cops gathered on the front steps of police headquarters. The squat, ugly building was clad in white marble that had been mined from the Tate Quarry in North Georgia, the same place where they cut blanks for tombstones. Fittingly, the men all seemed to be talking about death. Even from a distance, Maggie kept hearing Don Wesley's name. Most of them had probably never met him. She can tell from the numbers on their collars that they were from different squads, though they all seemed to have the same dark sense of purpose. This was the third instance where a killer had reached into the heart of the police force. The panicked determination that had marked the last two manhunts had evolved into an outright bloodlust. Nothing brought cops together faster than a common enemy. And Atlanta had a lot of cops. The city was divided into 7 police zones, including the airport and Perry Homes, a ghetto so dangerous it required its own separate police force. Each zone had a corresponding precinct. The downtown zone, Zone 1, used the bottom floor of the headquarters building for roll call. In practical terms, the location was ideal, but it was never good to be this close to the brass. Terry and his friends were always complaining about running into the police commissioner in the men's toilet. She guessed they couldn't decide which part of him they hated more, that he was new or that he was black. After months of open hostilities, Mayor Maynard Jackson had finally managed to push out the old chief of police. Commissioner Reginald Eves had taken over around the time of the Edward Spivey trial, which made a bad situation unbelievably worse. Eves didn't seem to care. He was on a mission to break the white power structure that had controlled the Atlanta Police Department since its inception. Suddenly, Terry Lawson had a problem with cronyism. Maggie could understand her uncle's anger, even if she didn't share it. The good old boy system was great so long as you were one of the boys. When Terry's group first joined the force, black cops weren't even allowed in the station houses. They had to hang around the Butler Street YMCA until they were called out. They were not allowed to wear their uniforms unless they were on the job. Most of them didn't have squad cars. They were only allowed to arrest other blacks and could not take statements from or interview white people. All of that had changed, of course, but men like Terry embraced change only when it suited their needs. The first thing Commissioner Eves did was clean house. In the span of a month, 6 assistant chiefs and over 100 supervisory personnel were demoted to the lower ranks. Eves handpicked the men who replaced them. A lot of new bosses want their own people, but because the old structure was entirely white and the new one was entirely black, people had problems. Lawsuits followed, but none of them had yet been settled. Next, Eves implemented a new testing system to formalize promotions. Before, it was all about who you knew, but Eves wanted to make it about what you knew. It was a good idea, but when no black officers could pass the test, Eves appointed a board of examiners to give oral tests. No white officers were able to pass the oral test. Lawsuits followed. No one knew what the outcome would be. Other than the color of his skin, the biggest complaint that Maggie heard about Eves was the color of his blood. He didn't bleed blue. The mayor had met him when the two were in law school. Eves had never been a real cop. He'd never worked the streets. Outside of headquarters, no one saw the commissioner unless they were watching the news or spotted his fancy Cadillac rolling down to the Commerce Club for lunch. Primarily, he communicated through daily bulletins that were read during roll call, which created another reason to hate the new boss. Eves was obsessed with paperwork. He implemented new rules about appearance, how to address the public, when to use force, and, most importantly, how to fill out the forms required by the federal government in order to keep the grant money rolling in. This part was especially important for the female officers. The only reason they were in uniform was because the federal government had bribed the city with grants to hire them. The women weren't exactly told to lie about their duties, but the grants dictated certain guidelines that the Atlanta Police Department was not going to follow. Mixed assignments being primary among them. No white woman would ride with a black man. The white men really wanted to ride with the black women, but the black women weren't stupid enough to get in a car with them. And there was no way in hell a black man and a white man would ride together. Maybe there was a reason Atlanta was statistically one of the most violent, criminal cities in America. As far as Maggie could tell, the only thing the black and white male officers could agree on was that none of them thought women should be allowed in uniform. Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss. Maggie climbed the 21 steps to the headquarters building. The brass doors were a tarnished green. The thin sliver of glass was oily from smoke and sweat. She took one last whiff of fresh air before entering the lobby. As it was outside, the place was packed with men. There was no joking or jive talking. The weight of Don Wesley's murder blanketed the room as palpably as the cigarette smoke that fogged the air. Even in their grief, they were true to form. None of them moved out of Maggie's way as she pushed through the packed squad room. A shoulder bumped hers. A hand brushed across her ass. She kept her expression neutral, her eyes straight ahead, as she headed to the back of the room. "Hey, doll." Chuck Hammond was short for a man. He came up to around Maggie's breasts, which seemed to suit him just fine. "Jimmy okay?" Maggie kept walking. "He'll be here soon. You can see for yourself. Listen, if you need to talk about..." Rick Anderson saved her. "Hey, Maggie, you got a minute?" "Sure." Maggie felt Chuck's hand on her arm, but she kept moving. She followed Rick as he cut a path toward the back. Everybody liked Rick. He was funny and good-natured and always laughed at everybody's jokes. He looked over his shoulder to make sure she was still there. "You holding up okay?" "Sure," she repeated. "Jimmy's great." "I wasn't asking about Jimmy." Unreasonably, Maggie felt the urge to cry. She couldn't remember the last time anybody had asked her how she was doing. "I'm good, thanks." "Madam?" He bowed slightly, indicating the door marked ladies. They both ignored the crude drawing of an ejaculating penis taped under the sign. "Thank you." Maggie cracked the door just enough to slide through in case anyone was indecent. Good thing, because Charlaine Compton had her pants off. She was dabbing clear fingernail polish on the ladder working its way up the back of her pantyhose. She saw Maggie and said, "I just bought these." "I have an extra pair." Maggie had to turn sideways to get past Charlaine. The woman's locker room was an afterthought, a narrow bowling alley of a space meant to store cleaning supplies. There were no toilets or sinks. If they needed to use the facilities, they had to go up a flight of stairs and use the public restrooms. Maggie spun the combination on her lock. "Chuck cornered me."
"Did he touch you?"
Maggie shuddered. "Rick Anderson saved me before he could."
"Rick's one of the nice ones."
Charlaine studied her. "Jimmy okay?" "He's mad. He wants to catch the guy." She handed Charlaine the white plastic egg from her locker. "Don was a good cop. He deserved better than that."
"True on all points."
Charlaine rolled the pantyhose so she could put them on.
"You should have heard my mother on the phone this morning. Why are you doing that job when you could get killed? What's wrong with you?"
Maggie was familiar with the questions. She floated out an idea. "Maybe they'll let us work some of the leads.
Maybe Princess Grace will come scrub my toilet."
Maggie thought about Gail's suggestion that they work the case together. More like a challenge. Gail knew how to push Maggie's buttons. As awful as it sounded, thinking about helping solve Don's murder was an exciting prospect.
But then there was the other component, which was that Maggie would have to turn the name over to Terry. She wouldn't just be giving Terry a name. She would be signing a man's death warrant. Then again, she could always feed the information to Rick Anderson and his partner Jake Coffey. They weren't Terry's kind of cops. They actually followed the law. Which brought up another problem. If Terry found out that Maggie had gone behind his back, she wouldn't be anybody's kind of cop. Terry was losing his power on the force, but he still had enough pull to keep her behind a desk, or worse, make her work night shift at the jail until she either got stabbed or quit. "Good morning, ladies!" Wanda Clack squeezed through the half-open door. She had a big smile on her face that dropped the minute the door shut. "Another cock drawing?" she asked. "Honestly, don't these boys have mothers?" Charlene asked, "How was your date this weekend?" "I told him I'm a cop and he stuck me with a check." Wanda rolled her eyes. "Maybe I should tell the next one I'm a stewardess."
"He'll think you're fast."
"That's exactly what I want him to think. I haven't been laid in 2 months."
The door opened wide.
"Hey!"
Charlene screamed, clutching her pants around her waist.
"Jesus, lady!"
Wanda pushed the door closed on the ensuing whistles and catcalls.
"What the hell?"
They all stared at the blonde, who'd stumbled into the room. She looked panicked. Her chest was heaving. At least Maggie thought her chest was heaving. Her uniform was big enough to pass for an Indian sari. You could always spot the new recruits by their clothes. They didn't get their uniforms until they graduated from the academy because most of them washed out before graduation. The guys in the supply room gave the women uniforms that were too large, while the black men got uniforms that were obscenely small.
"Listen up, Blondie," Charlene buttoned her pants. "You never open the door all the way, ever."
The blonde touched her trembling fingers to her neck. She was clearly on the verge of tears. Maggie was shocked she'd made it through the gauntlet. She looked like a light breeze could blow her right back out the door. Instead of asking the woman, Charlene asked Maggie,
"Who's this?"
Maggie shrugged. "I guess one of the new recruits."
"Shit, I forgot they were coming in today."
Charlene sat down so she could load up her utility belt. "She obviously can't sew," Wanda suggested.
"Maybe she thinks she'll get arrested for altering her uniform."
They laughed. The new girl stared at them like a caged animal. Maggie turned to her locker and busied herself with her purse, checking the things that she already knew were in there. She'd endured the same kind of taunts when she'd first put on the uniform. It was part of the initiation. If you couldn't make it in the women's locker room, you sure as hell couldn't make it out on the street. At least the jabs you got in here were only verbal. In her first month, Maggie had been spat on more times than she could count, and punched in the face by the wife of the man she was arresting for domestic battery.
"Where are you from?" Wanda asked.
The new girl obviously wasn't sure if the question was meant for her.
"Yeah, you," Wanda said. "Where you from?"
"Atlanta." Her voice was like money, so it wasn't surprising when she said, "Buckhead." Wanda gave a low whistle. She didn't find a lot of cops from the wealthiest section of town.
"Hoity-toity."
Charlene slapped Maggie's leg for attention. She held out her hand, and Maggie helped leverage her up from the bench. Charlene told them,
"Y'all've got 5 minutes before the colored girls get the room."
The palaver of male voices filled the space as she cracked open the heavy door. Wanda kept her arms crossed, demanding of the new girl,
"So hoity-toity, what are you doing slumming it here?"
"Just," the woman kept wringing her hands,
"working."
"Working."
Wanda had an ice pick for a tongue. She kept staring at the woman, obviously checking all the boxes that listed why she hated her. tall, with strawberry blonde hair and a model perfect face. Big blue eyes. High cheekbones, even without lipstick, her lips were cherry red. She had a couple years on them all, but there was something fresher, younger, more feminine about her. Wanda asked, "You here to meet guys? 'Cause I can tell you right now ain't none of them worth knowing." The woman said nothing, but her eyes told a story. She was going through her options, chief among them being to open the door and run away screaming. "Go on," Wanda nodded toward the door. "You wouldn't be the first gal to call it quits before roll call."
"I'm not quitting."
The blonde seemed to be speaking more to herself. "I'm not here to meet men. I'm here to do a job, and I'm not quitting." Wanda grunted. "We'll see about that, hoity-toity." Her voice got stronger.
"Yes, you will."
Maggie felt bad for the girl. She asked, "What's your name?"
"Kate."
She seemed to change her mind.
"Kate Murphy."
"Kate Murphy?" Wanda echoed. "We got our own Irish Spring here. Manly, but I like it too." Maggie smiled at the joke. Wanda sounded just like the woman in the commercial.
"I'm not."
Kate shifted, nearly losing her balance. Her shoes were too big. Her pants were coming unpinned. She was swallowed in a sea of navy blue wool. Still, she said,
"I need this job."
Maggie studied Kate Murphy. She was obviously scared, and there was no denying the desperation in her voice. But she deserved some credit for not backing down, especially since Wanda was in her cop stance, which even Maggie found intimidating. Wanda seemed to notice this too. She moderated her tone, but only slightly. "Don't wear the dress socks they gave you. Franklin Simon has wool ones, 2 for $1 that'll keep your feet in your shoes. Find a stapler for your pants. Those pins ain't gonna hold, especially if you have to chase somebody, and believe me, you're gonna have to chase somebody. Or fight somebody off, and with that figure, it'll probably be one of those monkeys on the other side of the door." Kate looked at the door. "Eyes back this way." Wanda wasn't done. "There's a tailor on Carver Street does alterations without copping a feel. He's a Jew, but he's reasonable." She winked. "Just don't stare at his horns. Makes him nervous." Kate seemed even more terrified than before. "What, you afraid of Jews?" Wanda was giving her the business again. "You got a problem with them?" Kate gave a slow half shrug.
"As long as they keep the hooves covered."
Wanda huffed a laugh. She patted Kate on the shoulder as she headed for the door. "Good one, Hoity. If you're still here by Friday, I'll buy you a drink." The door cracked open. Maggie saw a bunch of male faces trying to see if there was something interesting behind the door. She looked at her watch. "We'd better hurry before the colored girls get here." Kate glanced at the curtain splitting the room in half. She seemed horrified.
"It's segregated?"
"They change back there. They can't wear their uniforms to work."
"Why?"
Maggie felt her eyes narrow. She couldn't tell if this doe-eyed look was an act or not. "You ever talk to a black person and Buckhead don't have to come through the back door?"
"Well,
cops aren't welcome in the neighborhoods where they live, even if they've got the same color skin." Kate looked back at the door.
"Why don't you have a curtain, too?"
Now Maggie was certain she was playing some game. "Because they put one up first." She felt the need to warn her. "Seriously, though, if you get caught back there, they'll kick your ass. I mean it. They're mean as hell. Even Wanda won't mess with them."
"Oh, okay."
"Toilets are upstairs," Maggie said. "It's a tight squeeze. Only 2 stalls. Don't spray your hair in front of the mirror unless you want to get knifed. I'm Maggie, by the way." Kate said nothing. She just stood there, gripping the strap of her purse like she wanted to strangle it. or use it to strangle herself. Maggie asked, "You got a combination lock?" Kate shook her head. Maggie held open her locker. "Put your purse in here. Get a lock after work. There's a sporting goods store on Central Avenue near the university. Wear your uniform and they'll give you the lock for free. Actually, wear your uniform whenever you can. You'll get free coffee, free food, free groceries." Kate put her purse on top of Maggie's.
"Is that legal?"
"Anything's legal if you can get away with it." Maggie slammed the locker closed. "Welcome to the Atlanta Police Department."
Chapter 6. Kate sat at the last table in the back of the squad room, wedged between the woman who was hateful to her and the woman who was only marginally less hateful. Maggie Lawson. She was about Kate's height, with dark hair pinned into a bun on the top of her head, brown eyes, and a pretty face that would have been prettier without the uniform. Of course, the latter might be said for Kate, so she should probably be more generous. Maggie had been helpful in a begrudging way. Kate wondered if the next time she saw her purse, the wallet would be empty. Then there were Clack and Compton, the other two. Both short, one thick-waisted, the other thin as a rail. They bleached their short hair and wore heavy makeup, as if they were desperate to prove that they were still women. They hadn't even bothered to introduce themselves. Kate had seen their last names engraved on the silver bars pinned to their uniforms. She had to think all the way back to junior high school to recall a time she'd felt so despised by a group of women. Kate had been an early bloomer. She'd had curves before anyone else. She'd developed breasts before anyone else. She'd got her period first of all her girlfriends. And then, she didn't have any girlfriends. And the boys wouldn't stop staring at her. Which was pretty much what was happening now. Despite the fact that she was wearing the police equivalent of sackcloth, every man in the room found some excuse to turn around and look at her. Never in the history of civilization had so many pens been dropped so repeatedly. She ignored them all, even as she prayed that she would get partnered with one of them. The bigger and stupider, the better. Kate knew how to handle men. It was the women she was worried about. This job wasn't a lark. A police officer had been killed this morning. If Kate got partnered with Lawson, Clack, or Compton, it was clear that she was on her own. And the vulgar woman who stood with her feet planted apart and had a gait like a horse leaving the barn would be proven right. Kate wouldn't make it through the first week. She clasped her hands together so she would stop wringing them. There was the usual split-second panic when she didn't feel her wedding ring. 2 months ago had marked the second year since Patrick's death. He had been gone longer than Kate had known him. She wondered what Patrick would make of her current situation. There were probably two answers to the question. The Patrick she had married was different from the Patrick who'd written her letters from the jungle. He was 6 weeks into his tour when he started sounding like a different, darker version of the boy she'd married. He was obsessed with the new guys who shifted in every week to replace the ones who were sent home in body bags. They called them FNGs, which took Kate some time to figure out because there was no scenario in which her husband was going to write the word fuck in a letter to his wife. As if she'd never listened to a Richard Pryor album. Fucking new guys. Kate could never comprehend Patrick's hatred of the FNGs. He excoriated them. He railed against the very idea of their existence. They came in with their fresh faces and sense of purpose, and photos of their girls tucked inside of their helmets. No one wanted to know their names. Why bother when most of them wouldn't survive the week? That was Kate. That was why they didn't introduce themselves to her. The fucking new girl. She straightened her hat on the table, surreptitiously taking in her fellow female officers. The way they sat on the edge of their seats with their knees spread and elbows on the table. Kate felt like a prim schoolmarm,
with her legs crossed and her hands folded in her lap. She was one of eight white women in patrol uniforms. The other white women stood against the wall by the locker rooms. They smoked incessantly and wore tight miniskirts with skimpy tops that left nothing to the imagination. At first, Kate thought that they had been arrested or were waiting to be arrested, or perhaps looking for customers. But then she figured they must be undercover officers because, as bad as this place seemed, she doubted they let prostitutes stand around listening to the morning roll call. At the very least, she assumed prostitutes had better things to do. She turned her attention to the opposite side of the room. There were eight black patrol women across the aisle, the colored girls everyone was so worried about. The concern did not seem unfounded. There was something terrifying about the women, the way they stared straight ahead, shoulders squared, all business. As a group, they were intensely separate. This explained the curtain. They had walled themselves off from the world before anyone else could. In the front half of the room, the men were similarly segregated by skin color, though their ranks were higher in number, probably 50 altogether. Patrolmen sat with detectives in street clothes that would have been slightly more stylish 10 years ago. Nearly all of them had long sideburns and shaggy mustaches. They wore their hats inside and held their cigarettes between their thumbs and forefingers. The smell they gave off was overwhelming. Sweat, tobacco, and far, far too much Old Spice. Kate tried not to think about what it had been like to walk among them. She'd been literally manhandled. Her breasts, her bottom, even the back of her neck had been touched by some stranger. She'd never in her life been so roughly treated. Something about putting on the uniform had turned her from good girl to bad. It was as if they were telling her, "Come into our territory. Play by our rules." One of the men, a few tables away, tried to catch Kate's eye. She quickly looked down, gripping her hands tighter. She forced out a slow breath, trying not to choke on the cigarette smoke that permeated the air. No more daydreaming about Patrick. No more strolls down memory lane. She had to do this. A low murmur went through the room. A fat, white man with a bulbous red nose took the podium. Captain Cal Vick. He had interviewed Kate this morning and warned her to keep her breasts strapped down so she didn't give anybody a heart attack. Vick rapped his knuckles on the podium. "All right, settle. Everybody settle." The noise wound down like a music box. "Let's start this off with a prayer for Don Wesley. May he rest in peace." Everyone bowed their heads. Kate averted her gaze to the floor. Don Wesley. She was driving to work when she heard about him on the radio. The fifth police officer murdered in the last 3 months. According to the news reporter, the Atlanta shooter had struck again. There was a $5,000 reward. Listeners were urged to call the police department with any information. Kate had started to sweat while she navigated the downtown streets. She had wanted to pull over to the nearest payphone and call her family to let them know that she was all right. Then she had realized how foolish that would be. They would hear the details the same as Kate and know that she was safe. The reporter had given the victim's name, said that he was unmarried and had served with distinction in Vietnam. And still, Kate had fought the need to call her mother. Only when she considered how the conversation would go did Kate push herself to keep driving. The only reason to call her family was to tell them that she had changed her mind, that she couldn't do this, that she wanted to move back home. They would be disappointed with her. Not that they would say it, and of course, on some level, they would be relieved. But they would be disappointed. Which, in some ways, was worse than any "I told you so." So Kate had not pulled over at the nearest phone booth. Instead, she had pulled into the marked lot by the police headquarters building. She had gotten out of the car. She had walked the 3 blocks up the street. And then she had reported to Cal Vic so that he could wonder aloud if Kate's breasts were too large for her to safely run down the street. Vic said, "Amen," and everyone chimed in. "We'll get through roll call, then Sergeant Lawson will run down what's the what." Kate glanced at Maggie, guessing by her bare ring finger that Sergeant Lawson was a male relation. Vic continued, "Before I start, I want to make sure every single one of you peckerheads is out there with his eyes open. Nobody goes out alone today. Nobody runs off trying to play cowboy. We get this dirtbag together, you hear?" None of the women answered, but all the men shouted, "Yes, sir." "This ain't gonna be a repeat of 6 months ago, am I clear?" "Yes, sir," they repeated. Kate glanced around. Everyone seemed to know what had happened 6 months ago except for her. Vic started the roll call. "Anderson." There was a gruff, "Here," followed by another name, then another. Kate shifted in her chair, trying to keep her flashlight from stabbing into her side. She shifted again, and the handle of the nightstick jammed into her thigh. Kate moved again, and several people turned to stare. Her new leather belt was creaking, announcing her every move. She looked at Maggie, then Clack, then Compton, and realized their knees were apart to more evenly distribute the weight from the belts. Kate carefully uncrossed her legs. She inched her feet away from each other. Her face burned with embarrassment. She'd kept her knees together or legs crossed since she was old enough to sit up on her own. Maybe there was another way. Or maybe these women had something in them that Kate did not. She couldn't think about that. If she admitted that she was different, she would have to admit that she wasn't cut out for this. Frankly, she wasn't cut out for much of anything. She hadn't the patience for being stuck in a classroom full of children. She hadn't the training to be a nurse. Her father had gotten her 3 different secretarial jobs in a row, but Kate had been unable to keep any of them. Her typing speed was laughable. Her dictation was atrocious. She could fetch coffee and look pretty, but there were plenty of younger girls who were willing to do that for a hell of a lot less money than a grown person could live on. The police force had to pay women the same salary as men. They had to give you benefits and a pension. They had to train you, such as it was. Perhaps most importantly of all, they had to let you do your job. Kate had worked her ass off at the academy. She'd studied more than she ever had in college. She'd practiced looking people directly in the eye, raising her voice, standing her ground. She'd worked on not apologizing when someone bumped into her, not explaining herself in restaurants when her order was wrong, or asking for forgiveness before gently complaining to the dry cleaner that he'd ruined her favorite blouse. "Wake up." Maggie bumped Kate's elbow. Everyone had their spiral notebooks out. Kate's was in her purse, which was in Maggie's locker. Vic said, "Terry, you want to take over?" Kate studied the new man behind the podium. White, as with everyone else in charge, he had a thick neck and squinty eyes that scanned the room. Sergeant Terry Lawson, she presumed. He unfolded a sheet of paper and read haltingly, "The suspect is a black male. Afro, long sideburns and mustache, approximately 20 to 25 years of age, no distinguishing tattoos or birthmarks." He looked up, making sure he was being followed. 5'10", maybe 6 foot. Dressed like a hippie, Levi's and a red shirt, he wore gloves, black gloves. The weapon was a Saturday Night Special. Terry paused again as they all recorded the details into their notebooks. Even the blacks were taking notes. Suddenly, they'd all come together. Terry said, "Chipper?" Chip Bixby. Kate recognized him from the academy. He and a man named Bud Deacon had been responsible for teaching them how to shoot. Both men had worn matching red ties, seemingly for the sole purpose of telling the women that the only rule in handling a gun was not to shoot the men wearing red ties. Gentlemen? Chip waited for silence. The shooter carried a weapon similar to the pistol in my hand. He held a handgun over his head that looked nothing like the revolver Kate had been issued. This is a Raven MP25 from the original Ring of Fire. 25 cal semi with a blowback action. Hold 6 in the mag and 1 in the chamber. A piece of shit, this gun. Jams all the time. American made, so what's their excuse?
No excuse,
a drunken voice called. Jet Elliott. Kate recognized him from the shooting range. He was sitting in the front row, listening to the side. The man beside him held a hand at his back to keep him from toppling over.
Okay, Terry took over again. This Raven handgun is the type what took out Don Wesley. Chips has the wood grain grip. The one that killed Don had imitation pearl. Anybody not familiar with this weapon, come up after and take a look. I want the real deal in my hands by close of business today. That sound like a plan?
There were nods around the room. Terry said,
Since all of y'all are wondering, I'm gonna make it easy for you and lay out what happened straight from Jimmy's statement. I don't want no gossip after this. Nobody pimping to no damn reporters.
Jet spoke up again.
Nobody pimping to Reggie neither.
There were murmurs of agreement around the room. Reginald Eves, Kate assumed. At the academy, she'd heard a lot of whispers about pimping to Reggie, which she gathered meant reporting infractions to the commissioner.
Jet's right, Terry said. Everything I tell you stays in this room. No pimping up to nobody. Damn straight.
This came from the man sitting beside the drunk. They were strikingly similar with their cheap suits and bad haircuts. Kate wondered if they were twins, then decided they were both stamped from the same blue-collar machine that had spit out Cal Vick and Terry Lawson.
All right, quiet down, Terry said.
He bent down his head and read from the report again.
Last night around 3 in the a.m., Officer Don Wesley and Officer Jimmy Lawson received a report of a possible break-in at the CNS Bank, 5 points off of Whitehall Road. They went to investigate. Officer Wesley was on foot, checking the back entrance, while Officer Lawson, also on foot, checked the front.
Kate felt Maggie stiffen beside her. Another Lawson. The place was crawling with them. Terry folded up the paper. He rested his elbow on the podium like an old man telling a story.
Jimmy finished securing the front and called in a false alarm. He was maybe 10-15 feet away from Don in the alley behind the bank when out of nowhere this black brother rounds the corner. Brother fires, twice. Don takes both in the head. Jimmy goes for cover. He squeezes off 3 shots, but the brother hoofs it. Jimmy has to stay with his partner.
He paused.
Your partner's safety is your first priority, right?
Staunch, manly echoes of right bounced around the room. Beside Kate, Maggie put down her pen.
Terry said, We're gonna shut this city down today, gentlemen. Nobody does any business until we get a name.
There were whoops all around. Terry banged his fist on the podium.
We're gonna shake the monkeys out of the trees. We're gonna knock some heads. We're gonna get this asshole.
The bang turned into a drumbeat. Some men had joined him, hitting the tables.
Am I right?
There was an eruption of noise, banging on tables, stamping the floor, calls for blood. Kate wondered if this is what halftime inside a football locker room was like.
All right, all right.
Vic took Terry's place behind the podium. He calmed them with his hands, lowering the tone.
Jimmy's working with a sketch artist, so we'll have something to release to the press and TV news.
Vic raised his voice over the rumble of disgust.
Check your usual places for the Raven. See if anybody's pawned it or tossed it.
He stared over the crowd, expectant. Everyone turned to look at the young man standing in the back of the room. He was handsome, with an athletic build and long sideburns that framed his square jaw. Vic asked,
We miss anything, Jimmy?
Jimmy shook his head. His eyes scanned the crowd, settling on Kate first, then Maggie. Or technically, on the back of Maggie's head.
She was the only one in the room who had not turned around to look at Jimmy. She obviously sensed Kate's scrutiny. Maggie nodded toward Jimmy.
Brother.
She nodded toward the man at the podium.
Uncle.
Kate mumbled.
I'm sorry for what happened.
Maggie stared ahead. All right. Terry held up two sheets of mimeographed paper. I got your assignments. They'll be posted on the board. He stacked the pages together. This is serious business out there today, gentlemen. No chicks riding with dicks. Except you. New girl. Kate's heart jumped in her chest. He was pointing at her. Everybody was looking. You're with Jimmy. There were some wolf whistles and laughs. Kate felt her face turning red. That's enough, Terry said. Get to work. Remember, no cowboys. Kate turned to Maggie, hoping for help.
What should I?
Maggie stood up and walked away. Clack and Compton hadn't abandoned her, but Kate was under no impression they'd stuck around to help.
Jimmy boy, Clack said. Lucky you.
Kate tried.
I didn't ask.
Do yourself a favor, sweetheart. Put a towel down if you let him fuck you in the back of a squad car.
Chapter 7. Kate followed Jimmy Lawson across the parking lot, feeling like the walking embodiment of a Keystone cop. She had to shuffle her feet to keep them from slipping out of her too large shoes. Her nightstick slapped her leg. The hooks on her belt dug into her sides. She kept having to tip back her hat on her head so she could see. She felt as if her every move was being scrutinized, though the crowd around her seemed intent on leaving, not watching the FNG to see what mayhem would befall her. Despite Jimmy's quick pace, he walked with a pronounced limp. She wondered if he'd been injured in Vietnam. She doubted she'd find out his life story. He hadn't spoken one word to her, just nodded toward the door and started walking. Kate had prayed to be partnered with a male cop. She should have been more specific. Jimmy seemed to be the only guy on the squad who wanted nothing to do with Kate. He stopped to talk to a group of men. Kate recognized Jet Elliott and his seatmate as well as Captain Cal Vick, Chip Bigsby, Bud Deacon, Terry Lawson, and a handful of other men who could easily be mistaken for extras in a Sam Peckinpah movie. They showed Jimmy great deference, which was strange considering they all had at least 2 decades on the younger man. Maybe this was because Jimmy's partner had been shot, or because they were drunks making an effort to appear sober. Kate didn't know what to make of their drinking, and she was hard-pressed to care. Instead, she thought of all the things she'd left in her purse. And then she wondered how she was going to retrieve her purse at the end of the day. Maggie hadn't told her the combination to the lock. Let's go. Jimmy spun his key ring around his middle finger. The keys made a clinking sound every time he caught them. The noise corresponded with his limp as he made his way toward one of the last cruisers left in the lot. The white Plymouth Fury mirrored the early morning sun. The red and blue Atlanta Police Department badge on the door was faded to almost pink and baby blue. Jimmy popped the trunk so he could secure the shotgun over the spare wheel. He told Kate, check the car. She had learned basic patrol procedures at the academy. Kate knew how to take apart a back seat, replace a flat tire, and top off a radiator. She'd even learned how to pump gas into the tank, which was the only thing Kate learned at the police academy that had truly shocked her father. She inspected the inside of the car as instructed, checking for weapons or personal belongings that had been left behind. It was important to ascertain that there was nothing in the back seat that an arrestee might find and use as a weapon. The flimsy chain-link fence was the only thing separating the front of the car from the back. A knife, or even a sharpened plastic fork, could be easily jammed through the diamond-shaped openings. Jimmy pulled on a pair of leather racing gloves as he watched her.
You gonna take all day?
Kate locked the back seat into place with her knee.
Ready.
He unclipped the transmitter from the back of his belt, then climbed behind the wheel. He had to angle his leg because of his bum knee. When he shut the door, he gave Kate a challenging look, daring her to mention the injury. Kate unclipped her transmitter. She rested it in her lap, as opposed to between her legs, as Jimmy had.
I'm sorry about your partner.
Why? You didn't know him.
He turned the key in the ignition. Write this down, 'cause I ain't gonna repeat it. He put the gear in reverse, but didn't move the car.
Where's your notebook?
In my... She cut to the point. In the locker room.
Jimmy slammed the gear back into park.
Go get it.
Kate felt her cheeks burning again.
It's in somebody else's locker.
Motherfucker.
Kate flinched at the word. She didn't know why. She'd certainly heard it before. Fortunately, Jimmy didn't seem to notice her reaction. He leaned over and opened the glove box. Instinctively, Kate pulled away from him. He glared at her as he dropped a spare notebook on her lap.
First rule is, don't leave your fucking notebook.
She flipped the cover open to a blank sheet, but she didn't have anything to write with.
Christ.
Jimmy took a pen out of his pocket and threw it in her direction. Kate missed the pen. Of course she missed it. She leaned down to retrieve it from the floor just as he backed up the car. The brim of her hat slammed into the dash, sending a slash of pain across her forehead. Kate felt something close to a swoon. Her vision blurred, her stomach curdled. Jimmy pulled out onto the road.
Write that down, he said. Never forget your notebook.
Kate sat up. She pushed her hat back on her head. She was still seeing pricks of stars, but she clicked the pen, started writing, never forget your notebook. She felt like an idiot, but she looked to him for more. He said,
rule number two, you type all the reports. I'm not here to do paperwork. That's why you write down every single fucking thing that happens. Mark the time, what the weather's like, what people look like, how they sound, they crackers or hillbillies, south side or west.
He paused, waiting for Kate to finish. At least, that's what she thought he was doing. She couldn't help but notice that his eyes never went above her chest.
Rule number three, I'm the boss of this car. I say where we go, when we stop, where we stop. If you gotta pee every 10 minutes, you bring a cup to piss in. I don't want to hear about it. Got me?
Kate kept her head down, thinking if she just kept writing, the words wouldn't matter.
Rule three, section A. I always drive, and you shut the hell up about it.
Kate didn't have to write that one down.
Four, ask, tell, make. You ask somebody to do something. They don't do it. You tell them to do it. They still don't do it. You make them do it.
Her hand was cramping. She could barely keep up.
Number five, forget rule number four. It don't matter. You're not talking to anybody. You're not looking at anybody. You stay in the car when I get out, and you still be in the car when I get back in.
Kate looked up. This was the exact opposite of what they had told her during training. You never left your partner's side. Even Jimmy's own uncle had said as much during roll call. Jimmy seemed to read her mind.
I don't care what they taught you. There's different rules for men and women. You go out into the street, you're my responsibility. I can't look after me and look after you at the same time.
She stared down at the point of the pen, pressing into the white notebook paper.
You don't find it possible that I can look after myself?
He laughed, but not because he thought it was funny.
Look at this shithole.
He waved his hand out the window.
You think you can handle yourself outside this car?
Kate felt her eyes go wide. She'd been too busy riding to notice the scenery had changed. They were smack in the middle of the projects. Young black men were clumped around the street corners. Scantily clad girls strolled the sidewalks. She suppressed a shudder of fear. They were the only white people around. "Capitol Homes," Jimmy announced, as if it wasn't obvious they were in a government housing project. "Look behind you." Kate turned. The gold Capitol dome shadowed the complex. He said, "Funny thing. Ain't one of those windows looking this way. They all look toward downtown, where the money comes in. They don't see the filth and the trash the city shits out behind them." Kate took in her surroundings. Scores of two-story brick buildings dotted the complex. There were no trees, nothing on the lawns but red Georgia clay. Children who should have been in school were playing outside, their bare feet kicking up dust. The temperature was low, but people had their windows open. She saw old men sitting on front stoops. Women leaned out the windows to yell at their kids. Litter was everywhere. Graffiti, condoms and needles collected around the drains in the street. And the smell. The stench was indescribable. Jimmy slowed the car to a crawl. "You get a whiff of that?" Kate tried not to gag. The air burned her eyes and nose, cut into her pores. Sweat, urine, rancid food. Kate didn't know what the odor was, but she would never forget it as long as she lived. He said, "Roll down your window." Kate didn't want to, but she grabbed the handle. Her hand was sweating so badly, she couldn't get the lever to turn. Jimmy leaned across her and cranked down the window. He yelled, "Romeo, get your ass over here!" A black man sauntered over, his fingers tucked into the waist of his pants. He was dressed in wide yellow bell-bottoms and a vivid green shirt. The buttons were open so low that Kate could see the hair trailing down from his belly button. And then she saw it closer because he was standing so near that Kate's shoulder almost touched him. Jimmy said, "Stop fucking around, Romeo." The man finally leaned down and stuck his head through the open window. Kate pressed her spine so hard into the seat that her handcuffs pushed apart the vertebrae. Romeo asked Jimmy, "What you want, honky?" "You hear about Dawn?"
"What's that?"
"Don't dick me around," Jimmy warned. "Tell me what you know."
"I know y'all looking to do some beating today."
"You want to be my first?" Romeo winked at Kate. Like Jimmy, he seemed incapable of looking at anything higher than her chest.
"Shit, man, you know I don't know nothing about that. I'm just a businessman going about my business."
Jimmy lightened the pressure. "You got your ear to the ground." Romeo nodded his head.
"That might be true.
You get me a name, I'll give you a couple of passes."
"I'm gonna need more than a couple of something. My black ass will be toast, folks find out I'm helping you crackers."
Jimmy's face was stone. "What do you want?"
"I'll think of something."
"You get me that name, you better think fast. I don't leave no open tabs."
"I hear you, brother."
Romeo turned his attention to Kate. She held her breath. The odor off him was foul. Something sickly sweet, like burned candy. He showed her a row of gold teeth.
"You a foxy little thing."
To Kate's horror, Jimmy said,
"She is, ain't she? Blonde hair, pretty white skin, got them fine, full lips. I like to feel me some of them lips. You ever suck a chocolate creamsicle, baby?"
Jimmy chuckled.
"I bet she ain't." "Let me show you, baby."
Romeo's face got closer. Kate moved so far away that she was almost in Jimmy's lap.
"Why don't you pucker up them fine lips for me, gal?"
Romeo's shoulder moved. She could tell his hand was touching the front of his pants.
Come on, open up that sweet mouth for me.
Kate willed herself not to look down. Not to breathe. Not to scream.
Do you recognize that burned cotton candy smell? Jimmy asked,
like Kate was sitting in a classroom instead of about to be raped.
That's heroin. They put it in a spoon and cook it to a boil with a lighter.
Romeo's tongue darted out.
God damn, you the whitest white bitch I ever seen.
They pull the liquid into a needle and shoot it in their veins, Jimmy said. That right, Romeo?
Romeo wouldn't be distracted. His hand was doing things below the window that Kate didn't want to know about.
You just stay there a little minute more and I...
Jimmy hit the gas. Romeo slipped out the window. Kate was flung back against the seat. She struggled to turn around to get her bearings. Jimmy was laughing so hard that he had tears in his eyes.
You stupid bitch, he said. Holy shit, you should have seen your face.
Somehow, Kate managed to sit back in her seat. She clenched her hands in her lap, tightened her jaw so hard that her head ached. She hissed out, "You asshole!"
Asshole! Jimmy kept laughing. You cringe like a nun when I say motherfucker, and now you're calling me an asshole?
Asshole. Kate practically spit out the word. She was shaking. Her fists would not unclench. A volcano raged inside of her.
I'm the asshole.
Jimmy swerved the car into a sharp turn. He slammed down the brakes. Kate grabbed the dashboard before she hit it again.
Let me tell you, sister, what happened back there? That's why you don't belong out here.
She stared at him. He wasn't laughing anymore.
Why'd you let that pimp talk to you like that? What are these for?
Jimmy grabbed at her flashlight, her nightstick, her gun.
These for show, girly girl? You like the way they make your hips look?
Stop! Kate tried to push him away. He was made of stone. Nothing would move him. She started to panic. Please?
Shit,
Jimmy muttered, finally returning to his side of the car.
Better it comes from me than some pimp raping your ass.
He stared at Kate with obvious disgust.
Go on and cry. Get it out so I can take you back to the station.
Kate would gouge out her own eyes before she cried.
What the hell do you want from me?
What do I want?
Jimmy leaned over again, crowding her against the door.
I want you to get out of my car and take off that fucking uniform and go find a husband and have some kids and bake pies and play house like a normal fucking woman.
Her fingernails cut into her palms. She struggled to bring air into her lungs.
Get away from me.
Jimmy leaned closer.
Why don't I drive you back to Romeo? He'd cut your slit open like a fish, and then he'd pump you with H and toss you back into the street until you'd suck a fucking dog to get that needle in your arm.
Kate tried to turn away. Jimmy grabbed her face with his hand.
I watched my partner's head explode. I got bits of his brain in my eyes and teeth. I tasted his death in my mouth. You think you can handle that? You think you can come out here every day knowing what death tastes like?
Her throat filled with sand. He was almost on top of her. Her face was covered in his spittle. His fingers dug into her cheeks.
Can you?
He demanded. From somewhere deep inside, she found the courage to ask.
Can you?
Jimmy wrenched away his hand.
You got no fucking idea what you're talking about.
Kate touched her face. She could still feel his fingers digging into the flesh.
What is this?
She whispered.
What happened?
She wasn't talking to Jimmy. She was asking these questions of herself.
What gives you the right to talk to me like this? To treat me like this just because you don't want me here?
Jimmy shook his head like she was the stupidest person on earth.
Kate pushed open the door. She got out of the car.
Where are you going?
Kate started walking. The smell wasn't so bad. She could deal with it. The Capitol Dome would guide her back to police headquarters. She had a spare key in a magnetic box over the back tire of her car. She would drive to the hotel, get her things, and then go to her parents' house. There was nothing her family could say that would be worse than what she had just experienced. Jimmy got out of the car.
Where the hell are you going?
Kate took off the hat. She unbuttoned her shirt collar. The temperature was just under 40 degrees, but she was burning up. She breathed through her mouth, pulling great gulps of filthy air into her lungs. Jimmy was right. The awful women in the locker room were right. Her mother was right. She wasn't cut out for this.
Hey!
Jimmy grabbed her arm. She shook him off. He grabbed her again and spun her around.
Just stop a minute, okay?
She punched him in the chest. He wasn't expecting it. He stumbled back on his bad leg. Kate knew exactly what to do next. It came to her like breathing. She kicked his leg out from under him. Jimmy looked stunned. He slammed flat on his back into the ground. The air huffed out of him. Dirt clouded up.
You asshole!
She wanted to kick his head in.
I had a house. I had a husband. I had a life before all this, you fucking animal.
He tried to sit up. She shoved him back down.
What the hell is...
Shut up!
Kate leaned down to get in his face, the same as he'd done with her.
If my husband were alive, he would kill you. Do you know that? He would wrap his hands around your neck and strangle the miserable life out of you.
Jimmy stared at her, his eyes wide with surprise. He didn't have a comeback, couldn't seem to find the words to cut her with. So he just shrugged, as if to say, "So what?" It pulled the rage out of her. It brought her back to her senses. Kate saw that an audience had gathered. Men, women, and children. They'd probably never seen such a show. She had certainly never been a part of one. Kate had never hit anyone in her life. Even at the academy, they'd only let them punch padded dummies.
So what?
Jimmy was right. Patrick wasn't going to save her. No one was going to save her. Wasn't the point of this idiotic experiment to prove that Kate could save herself? Why had she remained silent when Romeo first leaned into the car? Why hadn't she told Jimmy to stop? Why hadn't she asked, told, then made them stop? Kate had an arsenal at her disposal. Her back had been aching from her belt the moment she'd loaded it. The heavy flashlight with its four D-cell batteries. The metal nightstick with the rounded tip. The revolver with five bullets in the cylinder. Any one of them could have been used to stop either man, and Kate had just sat there like a helpless simpleton. Jimmy sat up. He brushed the red clay from his pants.
What happened to your husband?
She looked down at him. He was kneading his thigh to work out a cramp.
None of your goddamn business.
You got a mouth on you, lady.
Shut up.
She turned on her heel and headed toward the car. Jimmy asked,
Where are you going?
Back to work.
That's it?
He laughed at her again, this time with surprise.
After all that, you're just going back to work?
She turned around. He was still on the ground, rubbing his knee.
Yes.
He held out his hand.
Help me up.
Help yourself, motherfucker.
The crowd of spectators cleared a path as Kate walked to the car.